This episode of The Orb is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for iPhone, iPad and iPod, Android, Kindle, Windows Phone, plus Mac or PC. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm.
This is J.G. Hertzler, General Martok on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome, Niners, to another episode of The Orb, our dedicated Deep Space Nine show. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me once again, as he always is my esteemed co-host, Matthew Rushing. Matthew, looks a little bit like a playground there behind you tonight. Why are all those children running around everywhere?
Well, Chris, I got conned into babysitting for 27 different couples tonight. You know, the life of the single guy, and they think I've got nothing better to do. So if you hear some children in the background, I'm sorry. Put that down! Get off the shed! No, I said get off the shed! Anyway.
Okay, wait a minute, Matthew. I have to ask, why do you have a shed in your room?
Oh, well, you know, I got to keep stuff, and it was the cheapest thing at Walmart to put things okay. in, and so...
It's like an outdoor utility shed, but it's over in the corner.
Yeah, I know, it's weird, but... no, actually, Chris, if anybody knows, that's a reference to Saturday Night Live, so back in the day.
Well, we're talking about kids because today we're going to talk about the subject of raising children on the station. You know, the whole setup of Deep Space Nine was the idea that if Star Trek were the wagon train to the stars, then Deep Space Nine was more like the rifleman, that a father and his son would go out to the frontier and they have to live in that town. And that's what the station Deep Space Nine was. And coming off of The Next Generation, where you had Picard, who actually asked Riker to help him not make an ass of himself in front of children because he didn't like children, and the famous, "Get off my bridge, Wesley." Here you have a series where it sets up the captain who actually is a single father raising his son in a very difficult environment. And Deep Space Nine, we didn't necessarily see that many more children on Deep Space Nine than we did on The Next Generation, but the difference was that these children were always around. This is where they lived. This is the environment in which they were going to grow up instead of us just seeing them here and there for a moment, as we did on TNG. So it was an interesting environment. And Matthew, you suggested this topic for today. What's your basic take on children in Star Trek, first of all, and then we'll move into Deep Space Nine specifically?
Well, you know, it's always interesting to me, Star Trek and kids. I mean, obviously the original series, there's quite a few episodes that have children in them. You know, The Children Were Lead, Miri, all these kind of episodes. A majority of them being really terrible. And then you get to The Next Generation, and yeah, Wesley turns out to be probably, for me at least, and I'll just speak for me, but the most annoying character ever created. And nothing against Will Wheaton at all. It's not his fault. The way the character's written is just terrible.
And let's just point out that on last week's Orb, we talked extensively about Grand Nagus Zek, and you're saying that Wesley is the most annoying character ever created.
At least for me, yes. and so he was just a character. It was just that syndrome that Hollywood loves to go through, which is the know-it-all child who saves everyone. Yeah. And it's just obnoxious. And I mean, on a ship with people that advanced, still the 12-year-old is the one that's smartest in the room.
Right.
And so it was really frustrating. And then, you know, we get to Deep Space Nine, and I think it's really interesting because you actually have a commander that's going to be the lead of the show who is a dad. And
who's a single dad.
Exactly. Exactly. And throughout the show, I think they do a fantastic job of writing that relationship, what those two together. And then, of course, you have the Nog relationship with his uncle and his father. And then, to a lesser extent, and this is the part where I think Deep Space Nine really fell apart here when it came to kids, is they do a really bad job with the O'Briens and their kids. Yeah. And part of that is more than half the show, they have Keiko somewhere off with the kids, and it just doesn't make a lot of sense.
That's a good point.
You know, to have this married guy have his wife off for at least, you know, a good 3 to 4 years out of the 7 years they're running, she's not really on the station. And so that's the part to me that fell apart, where I felt like they had a really good opportunity to, I think, show domestic life on Deep Space Nine, and they kind of missed it. Now, I do have to say, it was great, though, when they did show the O'Briens, because as we've talked about before, they're probably the most normal couple in Star Trek. They have normal fights, normal, you know, frustrations. I mean, other than when, you know, Keiko's being taken over by Paul Wraiths or, you know, things like that.
Right. Those things.
So, yeah. And then, you know, you get to Voyager and you do have children there. I always enjoyed Naomi Wildman. She's a little bit in the same vein as Wesley, but they never have her, you know, saving the ship 1,000 times.
Well, she's more like a normal child. Yeah. I mean, she's right. Not there.
She just happens to be really smart.
She's there to show that, you know, that I guess I take it as she's there to show that life goes on. I mean, they're trapped in the Delta Quadrant. Life goes on. Now, Voyager, I think you probably agree with me here. Voyager should have had more children on the show. It should have been a basic premise. Oh. That we goodness, have to have yes. children because someone's got to run this ship if it's going to take us 70 years to get home. And they didn't go that route. But at least in the case of Naomi, yeah, she's there and she feels like a normal child, especially for that time period. You know, she's accustomed to that technology and stuff around her because she's grown up with it. So she's very right. different from Wesley for me.
Yeah. And I think, you know, that was really, again, Voyager. That's one of the things it just lost was the ability to have more children on the show, kind of really showing a ship having to deal with the fact that these people were probably going to be there for, you know, ever, mm-hmm. and at least as far as they're concerned. And, you know, there should have been a lot of families starting on that ship. I thought that would have been a really interesting thing to have to deal with, of trying to get home, being in this dangerous part of space, and trying to deal with life going on and you know, having to live your life. So, and then you had the Borg children, which, you know, I didn't really have a problem with. They weren't that annoying or anything.
No, and they were around long enough for us to see them in a situation where they are having to try to adapt and try to live with the crew. They weren't the one-off kids like we saw in TNG, where you have someone like Jeremy Astor who, you know, we can extrapolate the fact that Jeremy Astor lived on the ship prior to the events of the bonding, and he continued to live on the ship afterwards, after he became bonded with Worf, but we don't know anything that happened.
Right. And so, you know, I think Star Trek does a better job of kids as it goes forward. I think Deep Space Nine really set the bar for what it should look like if you're going to do kids. And then Voyager did relatively well. That's right. I'm giving Voyager some praise. And then, of course, Enterprise.
You're forgetting one of the key kid characters on Voyager, though, Harry Kim.
yes. The biggest kid of all. Definitely. You did have Harry Kim. Yeah. It's a good... they do a good job after a while. And then, of course, Enterprise, we don't have any kids except for, you know, Trip and T'Pol's child that, you know, lives for a few right. days.
And that's only a short thing. Well, going on into DS9 specifically, because that's what we'll talk about for the most part the rest of the show, we have Jake, we have Nog, we have Zial, who comes on, who's not a kid per se, but she's a young adult. You know, she's still developing a bit herself. She's not to the place where, you know, the other crew members are yet. So in that sense there. And of course, you already mentioned Molly and Kiriyoshi as well. And then we see lots of Bajoran children who are on the station, who we see sometimes in Keiko's school, or we see them going to the temples or walking around, but we don't know that much about them. And one thing that I wanted to talk about, and this will be a little compare and contrast here, but in terms of being a parent and raising the children, what are the challenges that our characters face in raising the children, first on a Federation starship and then versus the station? Of course, with the station being the primary thing here, normally we see children being raised on a Federation starship. And what stands out most to me there is just the fact that they're being raised in a controlled environment. Everyone on the ship is there together for a shared goal. The ship is controlled by Starfleet. You know, all the resources that they're going to need to raise the children are being provided by Starfleet. I don't know if I'd call it ideal, but as far as parenting goes, I mean, it's a pretty clean environment. It's, you know what to expect for the most part.
You know, that's there's something I was thinking about today as I knew, you know, we were going to be talking about the show. And, you know, it really, the thought of raising a kid on a starship, as dangerous as it might be, with the situations you can get into, the actual raising of a child there is actually pretty safe. I mean, you have a core group of people who are all dedicated to the same things, all believing the same things, really, in a lot of ways, and it's a good, safe environment to raise children. You know, I mean, we don't get a lot of serial killer Starfleet officers, except for on Voyager, and things like that. So, it would be a pretty decent place, you know, to raise a kid. I think. I don't know, Chris. You're a dad, so you know, what would you think about having your kid, say, on the Enterprise D, the Hilton in space?
Well, I would have to put myself in the shoes, of course, of like I were a Starfleet officer and I had to be there. And so then I had my kids there because I think that I'm one of those fans who thinks that the idea of having a ship like the Enterprise D and putting families on the ship is sort of not a good idea. I think that, of course, you're going to have starships. If you're a spacefaring civilization, you're going to have starships where you have families who live on ships, yes. But the Enterprise is the flagship of the Federation, and you know you're going to be sending it into very dangerous situations. It's going to find itself in battles. That's questionable. But if I were in that situation, I think that, like, if I look at the real world and look at the education system and how difficult it is for schools to get funded. You know, when we lived in the U.S. for a little while, when our son was in kindergarten, his kindergarten started at 8:20, I think it was, and finished at 10:50, I believe it was. That was it. And the reason was that the school system didn't have enough money in Reno to have full-day kindergarten classes. And I thought that was just insane. Like, how is that possible that you don't actually have a full school day? What's the point of sending your kids to school for 2.5 hours? There's a little bit of social development value in it and not much else. And so if I look at things like that, and I mean, that's just one example from my own experience, but we know that all around the country and all around the world, it's difficult to get resources for education. But on a starship, one thing that Starfleet and the Federation would be taking into account is the fact that we have to educate our children. And of course, as we've talked about, actually last week, we talked about it a bit in Federation Values, that the Federation is essentially a socialist system in which the state is providing everything. I mean, if you think about the concept of education, like higher education, I know this was the case in the Soviet Union. I think something I was listening to just recently was the case, at least at one point in time, I believe Sweden is where they said, I know it is in other countries, where higher education is free, right? This would be the same case on a starship. The Federation Starfleet, they're going to pay for the schools. Everything's going to be set up. So as a parent, you have like nothing to worry about. You know that your kids are going to go there. They're going to be in the school. They're going to have good teachers. Everything's controlled. Like you said, there isn't going to be any serial killer or, pedophiles that you have to be concerned about. Any of these dangers that are part of our everyday real world life, that's not going to exist on the starship. So as a parent, yeah, I mean, it would be quite easy. But as we'll talk about later, there are a lot of concerns that I would have about whether my child would develop into a fully capable adult growing up in a system like that, on a starship with the same crew and this very controlled environment.
Yeah. You know, I'd say they'd grow up as normal as any kid can anywhere. I mean, there's no good way to raise a kid. Which just isn't. And you're a dad and you know that, I think. Some environments are better than others, but, when I think the idea of living on a starship and the people that live there and the morals and the ethics that they portray and all those things, I can't think of a better way for my kid to grow up than seeing them seeing the best of humanity and the best of all the other races that, that you've come in contact with. I think that's a pretty cool thing to grow up with. Seeing it firsthand, are there dangers? Yes. But honestly, on a whole, not every ship is the Enterprise. And getting shot at every week, most guys are off, like Sulu on a mission in the Beta Quadrant, cataloging gaseous anomalies, for 2 years. Really boring.
Right.
Yeah. Well, so
I think, so seeing the best in the people around you, I mean, that's absolutely a benefit for sure. And that removes one of those challenges as a parent, in that if you were raising your kid on a Federation starship, everyone there not everyone there, you have enrolled officers, but even the enrolled officers, everyone there, I was going to say everyone there has been through the academy, but that's not necessarily the case. But everyone there, I think, shares the high values and ideals of Starfleet. That's why they're in Starfleet. And even if it's not the reason they enrolled at first, that stuff rubs off on you. The station, on the other hand, you're dealing with many, many alien races and other cultures that don't necessarily believe the same thing or hold those values to heart. And so that creates new parenting challenges. And so to contrast life on a Federation starship, how do you see life on a station like Deep Space Nine for children and the parenting challenges that you face?
I think of Deep Space Nine is honestly just being like you live in a small town.
Yeah.
A small trading post. People are going to come in and out all the time. It really is like being on the plains in the wild, wild west. You have your core group of people who live there, and then you have people coming in and out. It does create a lot more dangers and a lot more things going on that you wouldn't get on a starship from day to day. It creates the feeling, I think, of living a much more quote unquote normal life,
right?
Because you're not surrounded by just a homogenous group of people who are all, kind of thinking the same way and pursuing the same goal. Living in a small town, all the dangers that come with that, all the crazy people you can come across with that. Yeah. So I think that was what made Deep Space Nine kind of interesting is, you know, you walked down the promenade and it felt like you were walking down the Gunsmoke, you know, town.
Right.
You know, you had the church on one side, the bar on one side, you had the restaurant and the sheriff's office, and you had the school, you know, all of those things that you would have. And then you had the train station with all the ships coming in and out all the time. Of course, yeah. You know, Nog and Jake were really excited when the Bajoran ladies came a parading by. So, you know, it's very much has that feeling of in so many ways, even more so than, you know, than Star Trek, of that Western style experience in life. So
I see it as a hybrid, actually. I agree with everything that you say about it being like a trading post and a Wild West, you know, town where you have so many people coming through all the time. I also see it as being a bit like a cosmopolitan city like Tokyo or New York or London, where these cities are not necessarily the best representations of their home countries because there's so much cultural diversity in the city. You know, I tell people in Japan, they say, I want to go to New York. I want to see America. I say, okay, well, New York's great. You should go there. But if you really want to see America,
yeah, go to Milwaukee.
Go to Oklahoma, or, you know, go to somewhere in the middle of the country where you don't have that type of cultural diversity that you have in New York. And it's the same with Tokyo. You know, if you really want to see Tokyo, I mean, if you really want to see Japan, you know, go to Kyoto, go to somewhere like that. If you come to Tokyo, you'll see Japan, but you're also going to have the same type of cultural diversity like you have in New York or somewhere. And so I see that as well. So it has sort of a big city, small town feel, the station does, where in terms of population and size, it's that small town. But in terms of cultural diversity and the challenges that you face as a parent and the things that your children are exposed to, it has more of that big city feel to it.
Yeah, I completely agree. With that, that's something I didn't think about is that you do kind of have, it feels small and yet big all at the same time. And, so that makes it for, you know, a much more, I guess that you'd say probably frustrating parental experience, you know,
yeah.
Obviously we watch Sisko go through that with Jake and then the struggle, even just in the first season he has, with the fact that him and Nog have become friends. And I think, we focused a little bit on that episode last week, the Negus, but it really, that's the episode, where I think, Sisko learns just one, how much he can trust his son because he's raised him well. And you have that beautiful picture of a father kind of getting over his own prejudice, of a race, and watching his child tell him that, and show him that. So, you know, again, I think this is where Deep Space Nine and the parental relationships with Nog and Jake and their parents really, I think, do a great job of giving us a picture of what it's like to raise a child in the 24th century. And I think that's really cool.
You know, it's a really good point that I've never really contrasted these two characters, but if we're talking about parenting and what you just said, which was really great, that it is a generational thing, right? Where it's not only a generational thing, but it's an environmental thing as well. So Sisko's been in Starfleet and he's been accustomed to being, the aliens he's around are generally also Starfleet officers. And then Rom is accustomed to being a Ferengi, doing things in a Ferengi way. You know, when we see him at the beginning of the series, he really is like the Ferengi, the stereotypical Ferengi. But the children, Jake and Nog, they come to this environment when they're very young, and children adapt so easily to new environments that you put them in. They are growing up with this very different diversity. And then, like you said, they're influencing their parents. And so really, Sisko and Rom are very similar to each other in that respect, that they both came to this station with a preconceived notion of, you know, how life should be and how they should view others around them and people who are different. And then by the end, they both change drastically, in part because of their children.
Yeah, I think it really does come off that way. And I think it's very true to life of watching, you know, parents actually learn something from their children and that vice versa thing. And they do, again, they just do that really well. And I got to give it to Sarak and Avery, because they play that relationship beautifully. And not only that, but I mean, as we know from all the interviews, for Avery, Sarak is really just another one of his kids at this point.
Yeah.
And he treats him like one of his own kids, and he feels for him the same way he does if he was his own child. And I think that's what makes the relationship work so well. And I think that's what was lacking, honestly, in just the writing and everything when it came to, say, Wesley. You just didn't get any of that, which is unfortunate, because it would have been a much more interesting show there, I think, if Wesley had been written more in the vein of a Jake. And they had really allowed Gates McFadden and Will Wheaton to play together, you know, like play well together. But they never really gave them any scenes, I don't think, that make that work either.
Well, you know, the thing about that is that, of course, Wesley is on there because he's pretty much Gene Roddenberry on the show, right? That's
right, exactly.
But in terms of the fact that we always joke about how Beverly never knows where her son is around the ship or what he's doing, I think that plays into what we talked about earlier about the environment of the starship, that it's okay. Like, she can let him just go do whatever because she knows there's not much he can do to hurt himself, and that all the other officers are going to take care of him too, that he's safe. You know, you don't need to worry about where he is, where Sisko does have to worry about where Jake is, because all kinds of things could happen to him on the station.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, that's a kind of a detriment, obviously, to TNG, but you know, that's neither here nor there. We're on the Orb. We're not on Earl Grey. We'll let them talk about that on their own time. Right. This is our time. So,
well, so we've talked a bit about the environment of the station here. Education is another theme, because earlier on we mentioned education on a starship, and it would all be provided by the Federation and by Starfleet. We do see on DS9, though, the challenges of education on the station when Keiko decides to set up the school. And there's going to be concerns about what they're learning in the school, kind of like last week when we talked about how the Grand Nagus was not happy about Nog going to school, but it was more about what he would be learning there. I think he would be, you know, polluted by Federation and human ideals. But just education, first of all, there appear to be no real resources allocated on the station for education. That's why Keiko has to go and ask Sisko if she can have computers. Is there a room I can use to educate the children? And then, of course, the whole debate comes up about what they should be learning in the first place.
Yeah, you know, it is difficult with the educational system there, because you know, obviously, beforehand it's a mining and slavery factory in space, so it's not really made for families and you know, the idea of education, one, and but two, the idea that, you know, now that you do have families there, and what do? And how do you create a society in which not everybody believes the same thing, but they all want their kids to learn something? So you really do have a good picture of what it means to live in 20th century, late 20th century, early 21st century America. and the struggle of educating, and how you teach, and what you teach and all that. And so, yeah, definitely. And of course, like you said, goodness, you know, you can't just let your kids wander around anywhere willy nilly because who knows what they're going to run into. You know, you don't really want your kid having a run in with a Nausicaan, ending up with, you know, a blade through their belly because they accidentally, you know, spilled, you know, some sort of juice on their shoe.
Right. Well, you can just see Ram and Nag going, oh, Damjot, yeah. Yeah, we play Damjot. Sure, let's play. And then they win, and that Nausicaan is happy. All kinds of things can happen. Then it turns out that the stick that they were using was actually Odo, thankfully, and then he, you know, materializes. Yeah.
Well, and then I think this is where we learn is you just never hustle a Nausicaan.
That's right.
So just don't do it.
But there are other dangers, too, like just the danger of kidnapping. I mean, we see, you know, they have to get Nag and Jake back from the Dominion at one point in the wonderful episode In the Cards, but that can happen.
Yes.
That's something that's not, I mean, it's not impossible that someone could be kidnapped off of the Enterprise, but it's not very likely, right? But whereas in the station setting, it's an everyday possibility, especially with all the ships coming through and, you know, you're trying to keep track of who's docking and who's leaving. But honestly, people come in and one day and the next day they're gone, and people forge records and, you know, give false information. You know, it's very dangerous.
Yeah. I mean, anything can happen, just like in any town that you live in.
Exactly.
And they do a good job, I think, most of the time of showing that. And the kids, you know, I mean, Jake and Nog are older, at least by the time they're on the station in the first place together. They're, you know, 9 or 10. So they're not children. And they quickly, you know, become teenagers. But, you know, having little children like, say, Molly and you know, Kiriyoshi, you know, those kind of children, yeah, you're going to have to be very careful with them, not just letting them run around doing whatever they want, because it's not unsafe, but it's just like, you know, I'm not going to let my kid just go run around, you know, 3 blocks of the neighborhood without me knowing where they are anymore, unfortunately.
I mean, so, I would be, if I were O'Brien, Molly would never be able to go to the promenade by herself. It's just like, you want to go to the promenade? Okay, I'll come with you. I just, you know, I wouldn't let her wander off, just like I wouldn't let, you know, my daughter at that age wander off into the middle of town here by herself.
Yeah, I think that's a good, and again, another a valid point. Although, you know, I mean, the station is, I feel like, a little bit more safe than just go wandering around downtown, say, New York, by yourself as a kid.
Yeah.
So.
But it would be really easy for someone to grab a kid on the station.
Yeah,
take
that's
him to
true.
A ship,
although,
and fly
we,
off.
We don't really see that kind of behavior a lot at all in Star Trek. And that's, I mean, maybe it's
no,
just
you,
not dealt
you don't.
With.
You don't, but
so,
that's where I think the, as much as DS9 breaks from the other Star Trek series in trying to show us a little bit more of what life is really like, they still don't actually reach the level of true real life, because we don't see that kind of activity taking place on Star Trek very much. But if Star Trek were truly being honest to real life, I think you would, especially on a station like Deep Space Nine, some of the characters that come through that station.
Yeah, I think that's true. You would definitely end up with some unsavory people walking around on the station. So that's true.
Well, let's talk about these are challenges and these are the negative aspects of raising a kid on the station. But I also see a lot of opportunities as well, especially when I contrast it to raising a kid on a Federation starship. One thing that I see there is that although it creates more unpredictable situations and more challenges for parenting, I think that it gives kids an opportunity to grow into more capable adults than a starship environment does. And the reason I say that is that I think that you can shelter children too much. You can create their daily environment in such a way that they don't really face real life. They don't face challenges or adversities, and they don't know how to handle those when they eventually do face them, which they will as adults. Whereas the station environment is much more, as we talked about earlier, a real life town or a real life city. It's going through all the unexpected things that pop up every day that you have to learn are part of life, and you have to learn how to react to those and how to deal with them. And I think the station environment is better suited to that. And I just personally think that for the children of these officers to become more productive, and you look at Jake, who decides he's not going to go to the academy, he's going to be a writer. I think that for Jake, living on the station allowed him to be a more diversified person than he would have been if he had grown up on the Saratoga, had it not been destroyed.
Yeah, you know, I think part of that is that at least in the starships that we see, they're almost always crewed by mostly humans. And, you know, I think on the other side, you know, if you had, you know, you're growing up with the Rikers on the Titan and the whole ship is full of an alien from a billion different species, yeah, it seems like.
Dinosaur
not
doctor.
Really a billion.
Yeah.
Exactly. You know, you would definitely be getting a completely different feel than just growing up on a starship that had more, you know, really just humans. So I think that's probably, though, the limitation of the budgets on the show, more so than anything else. So I take it that, and you, especially reading the literature as we do, Chris, we know that starships are more diverse than they seem in the shows that we watch. And so,
but I think
I can see what you're saying, but it would never be as diverse as something like Deep Space Nine.
Right. I think that works to an extent, but as I was saying earlier, I still feel that on the starship, regardless of what planet an officer's from, you're going to get a taste of the culture, but it's not the same thing. It's sort of akin to, let's just say you live in the United States and you have friends who are Japanese or friends who are German or friends who are Russian. You kind of get a feel for the culture, but it's not really the culture. Like the only way that you truly know what it's like is if you actually go to one of those places where you're around large numbers of people of any given nationality, any given culture, and you live with them day after day after day. It's a difference. It's sort of like it's exposure to diversity light. It's not quite the same. And so I feel like the diversity we see on the Titan, which is the most diverse starship that Starfleet's ever put together in terms of the crew, is great. And I think it's definitely a better environment than what we typically see on the TV show. I still think the station environment, though, gives you more hands-on experience, which gives you an advantage over those who were raised in the more controlled environment. And part of it is really like the hands-on life experience of encountering a situation unexpectedly, having to react to it, and remembering what you did so that next time you have a better idea, you can react more quickly, and these things become natural to you, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, I think, you know, those are all things that, you know, it would never be as diverse as living on the station. And so, And I think for the most part, in a really cool thing that we did get to see, again, one of the ways that Deep Space Nine, I think, does really excel over the other shows is as we've talked about many times, is giving us a taste of what it's actually like to live the 24th century life and play that out with family, with friends, with all of it. And so Deep Space Nine does a great job of doing this, at least through the relationships we see with Nog and his family, and then Jake and Sisko.
Yeah. Well, after all this discussion, I guess my final thoughts on it, though, would be that if I had a choice, I would raise my children in a city on a planet.
Did we talk about a planet, Chris?
No, we didn't. In fact, that's what I'm saying, that as we compare and contrast both of these environments, I think that my choice would be life on a planet somewhere for my children.
Yeah, I mean, I'd choose Bajor. It's beautiful. Sounds like a great place to grow up. You know, just wonderful plains and, you know, just great spring wine, you know, a religious community too.
Yeah, you could go play in the fire caves.
Well, I mean, the fire caves are fine until the paw wraiths come around. I mean, that only happened once. Yeah. So, yeah. No, I think, you know, I said it earlier, you know, there's really no good way, and I guess probably place, because there's nothing that's perfect to raise a child. And so wherever that is, it's going to have good things and it's going to have bad things.
Definitely.
And so I think seeing and what we've talked about tonight just shows that, you know, there's some things that are better. There's some things that are worse. But in the end, you know, if you have parents that love you and want to open your mind to all that's out there in the universe, you're probably going to turn out pretty good. So,
yeah. So as we talk about starships and stations and the differences in raising the children, I think we see where Deep Space Nine did present a very different environment than what the rest of Star Trek presented. But like you said, you know, it's ultimately up to the parents, and there are ways that you can expose your kids to diversity as well. So it's interesting, though, to see, you know, different approaches to handling kids in Star Trek. All right. But of course, kids on Star Trek, as much fun as they are, it's not the only thing we've been talking about on Trek FM this week. So here are a few other things that you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
Mark Cushman on Season 2.
Gene Kuhn was real good at writing comedy, and Gene Roddenberry did not want that for Star Trek. And Roddenberry just said, we are not going to go down that road.
Earl Grey.
The Borg on TNG.
But it's only one episode that we get this, like, technology-obsessed Borg until they become more of, like, a perfection-obsessed Borg. That they're trying to complete themselves, I guess. It's just kind of a strange anomaly.
There's a hole in their heart that only technology can...
Yes, Borg are the Jerry Maguire of You Complete Me.
The Ready Room.
Remember Me.
Well, one thing you didn't mention, that the fact that this is the only TNG episode to make it to Lilith Fair, you know... Will you remember me?
Okay.
Really? I mean, that's... You didn't know that? Okay.
The Orb.
Ferengi values versus Federation values.
We look at the Ferengi and we bristle at them because we don't like being reminded that if we lived our lives evolutionary-wise and that was all there was, you end up with nihilism.
To the journey!
Janeway's best command decisions.
I might be able to understand where you're coming from if part two of Scorpion was not completely devoted to explaining how Janeway was wrong in every single way. Warp 5.
Prequel technology.
You almost feel like photon torpedoes should have happened 50 years after Enterprise, and they should have gone through three different kinds that you've never heard of. Yeah. And that seems more real to me.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
Robert Hewitt Wolf on Trek.
Some elements that are in Deep Space Nine that I've never been able to quite fit together with other elements I think it might actually start to fit together once I understand R.P. Hewitt Wolf's involvement, who I like to call R.H. Dubs.
Literary Treks.
Editing Star Trek with Margaret Clark.
I try to make sure that the books are true to their series. That if you're reading a TOS book, it feels like, okay, Bob Chapman would have bought this story. He couldn't afford the effect, but Bob Justman would have gone into Gene and went, you really should read this, this is good.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all of these shows and get your daily Trek Talk fix. We have new Trek Talk for you every day of the week, and some days we even have two shows for you, and you'll find them in a variety of places, including on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, Windows Phone, Xbox, Zune, or you can stream or download from the website. So check out the one that interests you and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe. And Matthew, it looks like since our last show, we have had a little bit of feedback here by email. And it's from Daniel Handlin. What did Daniel have to say?
Well, he was talking about our Move Along Home show, Chris, which, you know, just turned into a laugh riot, I think. He says, hi, I really enjoyed the show on Move Along Home. I actually like Move Along Home. I know I'm a little crazy. That's okay. We've met crazy before. I know, and for just the reasons that you were discussing, I think it's an interesting science fiction idea that would fit well in TOS. Some of the TOS you mentioned, such as comparisons, Squire of Gothos, Gamesters, etc., I think of as classics. And while it doesn't fit as well in the DS9 setting, I think it was still a good piece of science fiction, which is what Star Trek is all about. So I very much enjoyed your discussion on exactly that topic, especially since Move Along Home doesn't exactly get a lot of appreciation on the other episodes of The Orb. Although I admit the hopscotch sequence is pretty ridiculous no matter how you look at it. You know, I think I have to agree with Daniel. You know, watching the episode again and looking at it through the eyes of does this kind of match with a TOS, I have a much better respect for the episode. Now, still, is it a good episode of Deep Space Nine? No. But not too bad. And hey, nothing like watching Avery Brooks have to sing and do hopscotch at the same time. Fantastic.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, Daniel, I'm glad you enjoyed that. And yeah, it just struck me. Like I said on that show, I was watching it and I've seen the episode so many times because I actually do watch it when I do rewatches. I don't skip it, even though I think it's not a very good episode. And it just struck me like, you know, man, if this were TOS, this would be pure gold. So there you go. All right. Well, thanks for the feedback, Daniel. Really appreciate that. And for everyone else, if you'd like to share your thoughts on the show, on Deep Space Nine, anything that we talk about here, you can do that in a variety of ways. You can go to trek.fm/contact. There's a form there. Choose to send to a show and choose the orb, and that will come to Matthew and me both by email. You can send us a voicemail through the website also if you'd like to, or you can go to our forums at trek.fm/forums to talk to us and other listeners about the show. And in social media, you'll find us on facebook.com/trekfm, and you'll also find us on Twitter, where we're always tweeting away about Star Trek under username trekfm. Now, Matthew, before we get to our own contact information, we also have an iTunes review this week. And this was really nice to see. This was from, and I'm not sure how to pronounce this, it's WSJINAMES. So it's WSJN names or something along those lines. But they gave us 5 stars, and they said that all Trek FM shows are well-produced and fun listening if you are into Trek. As with their other series-based shows, each program focuses on a broad topic, such as a character, a season arc, a theme, rather than being an episode review. It's fun hearing hosts who obviously love the series, but have somewhat different perspectives. He says, Chris is the heart of Trek FM and obviously loves DS9. That's just because I'm the publisher, so I'm on the most shows, so you get to hear my voice a lot. But everyone is the heart of Trek FM, as far as I'm concerned. But he also says one of the real bonuses is that the hosts also have perspective on the relationship of this series to the other concurrent Trek material, giving them an even deeper perspective on DS9 because of its contrast to the other series. And that played in well today, right, Matthew?
Yeah, I think it did. And I really appreciate that review. You know, it means a lot to us when you do spend a little bit of time and review the show on iTunes, especially the written reviews. We really do appreciate having such stellar reviews from you guys. And it does help other people be able to find the show. So as the network grows here at Trek FM and the shows grow, you giving us a 5-star review and a written review really do help us out. So you do that for us, and we'll definitely give you a shout out on the show. Thank you very much.
So thanks so much for that review. Really appreciate that. And Matthew, well, if people want to talk to you about Deep Space Nine or anything else, where's the best place for them to find you?
Chris, to do that, you could go to Twitter. I'm on the Twitter, the Twitface, whatever you want to call it. And I'm at MattRushing02. And so please hit me up there. You can give me an at reply. Let me know when you're following me. And we'll have a great talk about this episode or any episode of Star Trek, actually. I've seen all 700 and some odd episode hours. Plus movies and whatnot, and
you've read most of the books too. So,
yeah, I've read a lot of the books. So, that does that mean I remember all of them? No, there's only so much that fits in this brain, unfortunately, right, that I can recall. Now, you can find me on our other show that we do together, Chris, Literary Treks, where we do talk about the books and comics, and we've just finished the fall series there. Fantastic. And we also had a great episode with Margaret Clark, who is the freelance editor for the Star Trek books as well. So this is a fantastic opportunity to check out the in-depth, behind-the-scenes, behind-the-curtain look at what it goes into creating Trek literature. And then I do have my own personal blog at 42lifeinbetween.wordpress.com. Please join me there. And you can check out all my different types of reviews and just thoughts in general about all sorts of different things. Chris, when you're not hanging out at Quark's talking about parenting advice with Rom, where can we find you?
I don't talk to Rom about parenting advice. I talk to Morn. Morn is,
is
full of great parenting tips.
Yeah. Well, and he never shuts up, too. So you start him on one story, and by the time you're done, you're...
You never notice his kids? He's got like 6 of them. You see them running down the promenade. They all have the puffy suit on, but they're short.
Yeah, he's married to one of those other Dabo girls, isn't he?
He is, yeah. You wouldn't expect it, but, you know. Good job, Morn. So you can find me on Twitter as well. My username is C. Brian Jones. That's the letter C, and Brian with a Y. You can find me pretty much everywhere on social media under that same username, as well as on my own personal website at cbrianjones.com. And then on the network, besides doing Literary Treks with Matthew, you can find me on Warp 5, where we talk exclusively about Enterprise, very much the way we talk about DS9 here. You can also find me on The Ready Room every week with hosts from all around the network and special guests. We talk about Star Trek news and all 5 live-action series on that show, usually discussing an episode from one of the series. We rotate through, starting with TOS, all the way through Enterprise and back around. And I also have my own interview show called Matter Stream, where I talk to actors and writers and directors and scientists and all sorts of creative people about topics that are loosely related to Star Trek or inspired by Star Trek. So I check that out as well. Also, before we let you go, we'd like to tell you about our sponsor for today's show, and that is Audible.com. Audible helps us bring The Orb to you every week. They are the premier source for audiobooks. They have over 150,000 titles for you to choose from, hundreds of new titles coming out every week, so that number is probably like 160,000 or more by now. And they even have some of the most famous Star Trek books, like Spock's World and Federation and Prime Directive. They've got a number of Deep Space Nine books up there as well. And lots of science books, too, if you're interested in that. I'm reading a very interesting one right now called Our Mathematical Universe, which I'm probably going to tie into some sort of Star Trek discussion on one of the shows down the road. But all kinds of stuff for you to catch there. And as a Trek FM listener, you can get a free audiobook of your choice along with a 30-day trial to see just how great Audible is. And there's no catch. You know, if you decide after that time that you don't want to stick with Audible, You get to keep that free audiobook. That is yours forever. So go sign up today. I promise you're going to love Audible. I've been using them for 14 years now. I love them so much. Just go to audibletrial.com/trekafilm and sign up today. Get that free audiobook. Get the trial. That helps us bring the orb to you every week. And we really thank Audible for their support of the network. Again, that's audibletrial.com/trekafilm. One more thing you can do to help us keep the orb coming to you is to go get some aliens. We have original alien illustrations by Toba Ushi, who does most of the artwork that you see on our website. They're available as badges and as art prints. You can mix and match, choose which ones you want in which format. We also have different levels of contributions for you to choose from as well. And your donations help us pay for the cost of production, hosting, and bandwidth that's needed to bring the show to you each week. You'll find all those at trek.fm/donate. And we really thank you for supporting the network.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. And we'll see you next time as we gaze into the orb.